Oh my God. I am so excited and nervous and all of the above because my name is Mona Sheikh and I am going to be the host of a Minority Reports podcast and digital series that's making its debut in this episode. And I'm here in Las Vegas at the Show Creator Studio with our incredible guest. I have never ever hosted a podcast, so if I fuck up, you guys know what happened. It's my debut episode. But joining us is he's a straight white guy, but he's got so many minority aspects to this guy, and you'll discover it as we go along. He's amazing. I've done shows with this guy. He is he's done videos that just go viral every time. He's got the Midas touch, this guy. He's brilliant, he's hilarious. Give it up for my friend Trey Crowder. Welcome, Trey. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, Mona. Hey. Thanks for having me. I'm honored to be the debut guest.
You're a debut on Minority guest, man. Reports. I wanted a straight white guy just to set the tone on the minorities, yeah. You know?
Yeah, it's a bold strategy. Listen, that works out.
That's what I'm about, you know, those bold strategies, just winning over here.
Yeah.
Man, I'm very, very excited to have you here. I know you have your own amazing podcast that I've been on, which is Well Read Podcast.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. You guys have had that podcast, you and your two co-hosts, Drew Morgan, mm-hmm. right? Corey?
Yep.
And
yep.
How long have you guys had that podcast for now?
Let me see. It will be 4 years later this year, so I guess about 3.5 years now.
Okay.
Which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it. We've been doing that for that long, but that's about right.
I mean, now you have, you know, like I remember being on your podcast and, you know, honestly, that was like the single podcast that left such a impression on me because now your background is you were born and raised right outside of Nashville, correct?
Yeah, well, Nashville is the closest city to where I grew up. Yeah, but it's still 2 hours away from Nashville. Very rural, very remote North Middle Tennessee,
and
where I grew up.
And what was your town called?
Salina. Clay County.
Got it.
Yeah, we don't have any traffic lights or no McDonald's or Walmarts or anything. I
well,
graduated
that's a good
high
thing.
School with
that's
right. A- yeah, but we just don't have that. I just say that to, you know, let everyone know how much of nothing at all we have there. Like
yeah.
It's even the most ubiquitous parts of like small town America, we also do not have. We have nothing there.
So you're
very
saying
small.
That the city I come from in Pakistan has a little bit more going on than Salina?
I would be shocked if they didn't, yeah. But it's such a low bar.
Wow, man! Karachi's got more going on than Salina. I'm shocked to hear that. That's that's incredible. I remember this one. So you and I come from such different backgrounds. So I was born and partially raised in Pakistan, and you're from Salina. And I remember when I was on your podcast, one of the things that really stood out to me was about our childhoods and how similar our childhoods were, and how similarly we thought, and then just ended up being stand-up comics. So I just kind of wanted to, you know, we'll get into your awesome credits and stuff, but I wanted to really talk to you about, do you feel like stand-up comedy has always been your calling? Like, this has been, like, it for you?
Almost always, and what I mean is my dad actually had a video store when I was a kid. I don't know if you remember what those things
of
were.
Of course I do. I'm old enough, yeah. Man. I'm old enough.
It was a converted single wide trailer that, called Crowder's Video, that he rented VHS tapes out of in our tiny little sleepy hamlet there, Salina, Tennessee. And I had so I don't ever remember one. I didn't even know what this meant when I was like really young, but I mm-hmm. always wanted to just like do that, like make movies or whatever. But again, I didn't understand what any of that even meant. I just knew I wanted to do something in that area. And then from about 12 years onward, it specifically solidified as stand-up comedy in particular, because I saw me and my dad watched Chris Rock Bigger and Blacker on HBO
That's
when
nice.
I was 12 years old, and that was the first time that that kind of crystallized for me. So, I mean, you know, since I was 12, at least, yeah, it's been stand up for sure.
I mean, it's to me, Bigger and Blacker was the first special ever by a stand up comic that I memorized. This is
me too. Yeah. I knew every single word to it. I watched it so many times.
Exactly. I mean, what was that? Was that like, for, you know, you grew up in an environment, I would think, that's, you know, I guess conservative or so what was that like? Like you're sitting there and like you're watching, you're 12. Chris Rock is edgy. You know, he's using colorful language. So your dad is what, cool with you watching this and kind of memorizing it? And
my dad was honestly, at times, looking back on it, my dad was almost too cool about the stuff he would let me watch, you know, because not Chris Rock was, you know, perfect, I think, for, you know, how old I was and, you know, all of that at the time. But my dad was so, like, open about letting me watch different types of content because he owned that video store or whatever. I mean,
sure.
I, you know, R-rated movies and whatnot, but also weird movies. Like he would show me like David Lynch movies and shit when I was frankly too young for that. not even because of just it being like disturbing, although that too, but more just like there's no way that I was going to wrap my head around that type of thing. So Chris Rock didn't even come close to like registering with my dad as something that his 12-year-old son maybe shouldn't watch, you know what I mean? But I also should, it wasn't just that he let me watch it. I mean, that was a big part of it, but he loved it too. Like I remember him just like laughing his ass off throughout the whole thing. Cause that special is the one where Chris Rock gets into the whole thing about dads and like nobody gives a shit about dads. All anybody ever talks about is moms and nobody ever talks. All daddy gets is the big piece of chicken, you know, like that whole bit.
Yeah.
And I remember my dad just losing his mind at that. Cause my mom and dad were divorced and my dad, you know, I pretty much was raised by a single father. So I know that whole bit in particular, he just was losing his mind. And, you know, that had an effect on me. So,
yeah. I mean, like, do you feel like because I guess your parents got divorced early and, you know, you kind of grew up, like you said, with a single dad. Do you feel like as a young child, you were kind of using comedy or like, I guess, creating your own form of entertainment to escape? Like, is that something that...
Yeah, probably. I don't remember like conscientiously thinking about it in that way or anything, but I do think that was probably what I was doing at the time. Like I was always like the funny kid in my group of friends or the funny kid in my class. I'm from a little redneck town. There was a lot of funny characters in my school, but I was always one of the funny ones. And I mean, again, I didn't think about it in that way at the time, but looking back on it, I do think that a big part of that was because like so many different aspects of my life were not at all funny and were, you know, difficult or dark or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think it was just like a natural defense mechanism or something.
Sure. I mean, like, do you have friends that you keep in touch with from that kind of time? And are they... when they hear you're a stand-up comic, they're like, yeah, that makes sense. We need
that. My like closest friends from growing up in Salina are still my very good friends to this day. We all get together at least once a year, normally in the summer, and like go out on the lake or something like that.
Yeah.
But I'm in touch with them all the time. We got a group text, you know, that's ongoing. I mean, I'm talk to them a lot and try to see them at least once a year. And we've been that tight like that since we were children. And so, yeah, they knew that I wanted to do stand up for years before I ever did it. They right. all would tell me then like, yeah, I think you'd be good at that. You should do that. And then from the time I very first started doing it, they would all come out to open mics and stuff that I was doing. So, wow. I mean, they've pretty much been with it the whole time. I do think that some friends I made later in college and stuff who didn't know me like as well.
Sure.
I do think that a lot of them still sort of have that reaction sometimes. I'm sure they don't all have it, but I think a fair number of them find out, you know, Trey's a stand-up comedian now, and they're like, yeah, I can see that.
I mean, can I borrow your friends? Because my family refuses to come out and watch me do stand-up, like...
Yeah, I don't know if you know, be careful what you wish for. You're a bunch of drunk wild asses at your next show.
I'd rather take that. I'd take any kind of attention at this point. My family is I was in Dallas. My family lives in Dallas, and I was visiting them, and I had shows lined up. And my brother were like, "What are you doing tonight?" I said, "I got shows. You guys want to roll with me?" And they were like, "Nah, we're gonna stay home and watch television." I was like, "Yeah, that's cool. That's more important."
Are they afraid? Do you think it's just disinterest, or you think that it's that they're worried about what they're going to hear you saying, and they'd rather just not hear you say that?
That's correct. It's exactly the latter. It's they don't want it. My brother has straight up told me that he has friends that watch my comedy and love me, but my brother's like, I can't get down with some of the language and can't get down with some of the topics you're talking about. So I guess they just don't want to see their baby sister sling dick jokes on stage.
Oh, I mean, I have friends or extended family members and stuff who are in that same boat you just described, who haven't ever come see me perform and likely won't. And it's for that reason, because they know obviously the types of things that I talk about.
Yeah.
And they'd rather just not come and know they're going to get offended at me or whatever, and just, you know, sit at home and not have to worry about it. But I'm kind of fine with that, though.
Yeah.
But it, for me, it's not all of them, you know, like if it was all of my friends and family, like you were saying, then I mean, yeah, I would probably, you know, be a little upset.
Yeah, none of my brothers, you know, I have four older brothers. None of my brothers have ever been to any one of my shows ever.
Yeah.
And my mom shows up and she can't understand half the shit I'm talking about because language barrier is a beautiful thing. So that saves me quite a bit. But yeah, it's just not a thing. I mean, like now with you kind of, you know, your career taking off and you're doing a lot of bigger and better things. I mean, I really wanted to get your take on what's happening with the PC culture. Like what are your kind of thoughts, and how do you think it affects you and your comedy and comedy in general, I guess?
I don't know, honestly. I go back and forth on it depending on the day, frankly. Like, I think almost any comedian you can talk to, there are times where I read something, some tweet about a blog post of somebody getting offended by something or whatever, and I, you know, my eyes roll out of my head, and I think to myself, God, this shit is getting completely out of hand, you know?
Yep.
But then there are other times where I think that it's kind of overblown to an extent, like that it just that there really aren't as many people who feel that way as we are all led to believe sometimes, you know, because of the way the internet and social media and everything works. Somebody writes one of those blogs, you know, one of these people that, you know, gets paid to be offended by things, and they write a blog post about it or something, and that gets passed around a little bit. But I mean, that's one person. And a lot of times the people that are passing it around are doing so in a way that's like, can you believe this horseshit? You know, but it still gets propagated and still gets made to seem like it's this widespread opinion. And sometimes I'm not sure how accurate that really is. Like, I think the best example from recent history was, you know, Chappelle's last special, which was very controversial. And like, there were all these hot takes about it. And people, you know, all kinds of articles written, just keyboard set aflame with offense and everything. But like on Rotten Tomatoes or whatever, the critics rating for that special was like in the basement, like 20% or something like that. But the audience rating for it was like 97 or 98 or something. So I think it's just like, that's a good example of what I'm talking about. Really, most people don't really care all that much about that type of thing.
Right.
But it gets blown way out of proportion. But having said that, it's definitely worse than it used to be, you know, for sure. And if we keep trending in that direction, then who knows? But I do think it kind of gets a little blown out of proportion sometimes.
I'm right there with you. I feel like if we're going to keep walking down this PC train, we're going to be down to knock-knock jokes, and people are going to be offended by those too. So, I mean, I agree with you. I think some things you're just like, okay, well, you know, like that guy who was auditioning for SNL, remember? And he, like, a year earlier, he was doing a podcast, and they were talking about Chinese folks, I guess. They were talking about Asians.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a little too blatant and a little too much. But you believe that. I mean, you believe, like, look, as stand-up comics, we should be able to talk about whatever the fuck we want, right?
Yeah, for sure. And here's the thing, like, even with him, like, I think I still believe that ultimately that we haven't lost that ability yet. Like, I still think that we can talk about almost anything. It's just, it has to be like truly undeniably funny, or you have to have like a undeniable take on something, even if it's offensive. And I still think that even today, if you have that, then you can talk about almost anything. And like with that dude in particular, the thing that he got all that shit for, it was barely even like a joke. It was kind of just saying the racial slur for Chinese people and over and over again.
That's right.
If it had been like part of a well-crafted, you know, bit that was genuinely funny, I don't know. I think he would have kept that job. I really do. So
I feel like it's hard. Yeah, I feel like if anything is hysterical and it's like undeniably well-crafted, people digest it. They're like, you know, it's maybe a little offensive, but it's hilarious. So that's therefore I'll digest it. But when it's not funny, which was definitely in his case, where he's just talking about fucking Chinese people trying to trick you into eating food with MSG in it, it was just like, all right, dude, like, what's your beef? Which, if you have problem with Chinese food, then just don't order Chinese food. You know what I'm saying? Like, you know, to just rope everybody into it.
I don't know him. I've never met him. Of course, I read all about all that when it happened, listened to it all and everything at the time.
Yeah.
But I don't know the guy. But, like, I could even believe that, like, that he doesn't genuinely have any real problem with Chinese people, or he's not genuinely racist. Right. He was just doing, you know, he's like an edgy comic who's talking to other comics and it's just like, oh, isn't it hilarious how blatantly racist I'm being right now? Because that's fun, you know, because we all think that's funny, right?
Right.
And, you know, like that sort of hyper edgy type of shit.
Yeah.
That, I mean, if he said, look, that's what I was doing, and I get that it wasn't funny, but I'm not actually racist. I mean, I could even still buy that, but it's just that I don't know. I mean, in today's day and age, I think you just got to know better than to do some shit like that.
I mean,
listen,
I got in a lot of shit. I made my debut on The Young Turks. You've done The Young Turks, right?
Yeah. Yes, I have.
Yeah. So I was on The Young Turks, my debut. And, you know, they, like, put you through fucking grad school, right? Like, they're like, here's an hour before you show up, 10 stories, come up with jokes, read it, you know, like, research, and, like, bam. And then you don't get a chance to test any of your jokes out. You show up, and then you say one wrong thing, and people are, like, up your ass about it. So one of the stories that we're doing in my debut for The Young Turks was about talking about the female president of Ethiopia. And I was like, yeah, that's freaking amazing. Like, congratulations to Ethiopia for doing so, right? I mean, we're struggling to get a female president in the White House. I mean, you know, Ethiopia is like beating us to the punch. And I said, my response was, and I was just like, you know, shit is bad for America when Ethiopia is beating us to the punch. And people made it about race. Okay. People made it about race.
What?
They were like, this fucking Indian bitch.
Punch?
I was like, I'm Pakistani,
like,
but that's cool. Huh?
Huh? What do you mean? Like they thought you were talking about like fruit punch? Like
no, don't talk about
Kool-Aid
fruit.
Or something.
I'm talking about beating to the punch in the sense that, you know, we're the world leaders, right? People, like, the world looks up to us for setting trends, and here's Ethiopia, which most of the time, people around the world don't look at Ethiopia as the leader of the world. They look at America, and Ethiopia is able to beat us in getting a female president while we're still struggling. Like, their male politicians are coming out and saying, look, we need female leadership. Like, women have not been treated equally in our country. And I was just like, yes, God bless Ethiopia. This is fantastic that they're doing so. And people lost their shit over me. Like,
well, here's what I thought when you said that. I laughed because I thought, here's the joke I thought you were making. I understood what, like, you actually meant at a surface level.
Yeah.
But the joke that I interpreted that as, you know, it's gotten bad for America when Ethiopians are beating us to the punch, meaning like we're fat and love punch, you know, because Americans love punch because we're fat.
Which is not that far from the truth,
drink.
By the way.
Right, yeah. I thought it was an Americans are fat, Ethiopians are skinny joke is what I thought you were saying. You know,
Ethiopians are
they should never beat us to the punch.
But beat us to the fruit punch. Then I would say the fruit punch. That's what I would say.
But then you said people made it like racial.
Yeah.
And I get what you mean now. I get what you mean. They thought you were saying it's a damn shame when America is being, you know, when America is following the lead of a black country, right, of an African, yeah, a country right, run by black people.
Right. And it wasn't wasn't even thinking about race. I was just
like,
if it was Canada, if it was any even European country, I would say the exact same thing. It wasn't even thinking in racial terms, and people made it about race. And it just really made me kind of step back. And I was like, well, wait a minute. I was like, am I going to stop making jokes like that, or I have to constantly edit myself? You know, to satisfy people. And I was just like, but that's not even the intent I came from, you know?
I'm obviously, you know, pretty darn white, and my wife is
really
just
Trey,
exceedingly white.
I could never tell.
But my wife is like crazy white. I mean, I don't know. I'm sitting in like her office right now and see all this just a menagerie of whatever kind. There's a fur coat right here.
Listen, if there's a break-in in your house tonight, Mona showed up, because I'm a clothes fanatic. So,
well, she is too, but like, I joke about, like any married person, I joke about my spouse.
Yeah.
Sometimes, and I'll tweet about tweet something joking around about just how white she is, you know, about like various examples. I can't remember. None of them are that great. They're all pretty run of the mill. And I've done a few of them, but I've almost every time there'll be at least a few people who get pissed off when I tweet these things about how white my wife is. And it's like, sometimes some of them have gotten mad because they interpret it as me like bragging about it. Like, you know what I mean?
Like bragging about your whiteness?
About her whiteness.
Her whiteness,
it's
rather,
like,
yeah.
I'm bragging about, like, the, as though what I'm saying is, and it's not, mm-hmm, that the best type of wife to have is obviously a white wife.
I would never even think that if you tell me that.
Yeah, well, I know, because you're not a crazy person. Because that's, like, that's never what I'm saying or what I mean.
Right.
But I've had people, like, you can never underestimate the internet's ability to like misinterpret something, or to, you know, take something completely the wrong way.
That's
and
right,
get furious about it.
Just constantly taking,
like, it is what it is. You
yeah,
know, so.
Constantly taking things out of context, and you know, it's just like, you're just like, well, wait a minute, I'm a minority too. I would never demean another person. Like, that's not my intent. Like, I wasn't even thinking that. So it's just, I think it's just getting a little crazy out there, which is, I feel as a stand-up comic, I just feel kind of a little bit under attack. But, you know, it is what it is. And I guess we're all in the same fight, and just kind of fighting the same fight over here, you know? But I do, so I want to take this back to this conversation you and I had about our childhoods, right? This is like really great. So I think on your podcast we talked about pain, right? So I'm a big, I feel like a stand-up comics, and please chime in on this, I feel as stand-up comics, a lot of stand-up comics, the reason there's a lot of mental health problems that I feel that are in the comedy community. I about 2 months ago, Forbes interviewed me about mental health and comedy, right? And I told them, I was like, look, I've suffered from severe depression, severe anxiety. You know, my God, I've been in therapy for like 14 years. I have a lot of trauma that I had to kind of overcome. And I feel like that trauma drives me, and that pain has driven me to do the things that I do and continue to do. Do you feel like your pain has been your biggest driver?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, without a doubt. I think one of the biggest, I don't know, I think about this exact thing and struggle with it quite a bit, because I have my own children now, and it's weird because on the one hand, I like do everything in the world that I can to make sure that they never have to go through the type of things that I went through as a kid. Because I mentioned earlier, my parents got divorced when I was young, but also like we were dirt poor. My mom got addicted to drugs. She was in and out of jail and all this type of stuff. I had multiple family members who died from drug addiction or whatever else. You know, my dad got sick when I was, you know, in like high school, and was still kind of sick for years and years after that, until he passed away, like when I was in my early 20s. So like a lot of rough shit. And it's very important to me to like shield my sons from any of that type of like trauma. Mm-hmm. But then there's another part of me sometimes that thinks like, you know, I don't want them to grow up like as just like spoiled little brats who don't know how to handle any kind of adversity or anything like that either. You know what I mean? Like, because I do think that one of the main things you get from an experience like that is the ability to not just completely lose your shit whenever anything goes off course a little bit or something doesn't go exactly your way. You know what I mean? Like, you don't freak out the way that I think people who had like a more privileged and sheltered upbringing, like they freak out, you know, when their toilet gets stopped up or something like that.
Sure.
But like, if you, you know, went through some shit when you were younger, you can kind of roll with the punches a little better.
Cause trauma just gives you that extra layer to take those punches. You know, when life throws those jabs at you, you're just like,
yeah,
oh, I've been through this trauma before. I can handle this. I mean, you know, like you come from trauma, and I feel like a lot of good comics come from trauma, but you know, look, for me, it's like it took me 10 years to kind of find the courage to even talk about on stage how my dad used to beat the shit out of me till I was like 15. Like a month before I moved from Pakistan, my dad beat me so hard that like I had earrings like this and they just went flying out of my ears, you know. And I remember that was the last time I looked at my dad, and I was like, if you ever touch me again, I'll kill you in your sleep. And my dad was like, oh shit. And then a month later I moved here, and then, you know, I lived in America and I was with my brothers. We were like this poor immigrant family that live in Jersey City, which I bet Salina is like so much better than Jersey City. I bet, like, with no traffic, with no Walmart, I'd take Salina any time of the day over Jersey City. And you know, I have you're like, okay, why don't you just visit the first planet?
You say that now.
You motivate me to go to Salina now, man.
Well, please don't let me do that to you or anyone else.
Can't be that bad, man. Like, no Walmart,
no,
I'm down.
It's not that bad. It's very, very, very pretty. We have a lake there that's beautiful. It's a gorgeous area.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, economically and otherwise, it's really been through the ringer over the past few decades.
Sure. Yeah, I just feel like, do you feel that your comedy, like most of it, comes from pain? I mean, you're a pretty heavy duty political comic.
Yeah, well, before I had my videos that went viral and everything, that they're like extremely political. They're called the liberal redneck. Obviously, I was aware that they were very political when I first started them. But also when I first started doing them, they were just like, this was just another, like, you know, little comedy project that I was going to give it a shot and see what happens. I didn't know that they were going to turn out to be like my calling card or the thing that like opened the doors for me and that and all that. I had no idea that was going to happen. And before that, I would not have self-identified as a political comedian. I always did talk about things that were like risky or edgy to talk about, like in comedy clubs in the South, you know, like I would do jokes about religion or jokes about racism or jokes about homophobia or poverty, whatever, all that type of shit. But to me, that was more like just your general like social commentary, you know, than straight up like political jokes. Yeah. But to a lot, it's kind of a gray area, though, I understand, you know, because like to a lot of people that would be considered like political comedy also. So depending on how you define it, yeah, I guess I'm pretty political, but I'm almost exclusively talk about even those things from like my personal perspective on them. Do you know what I mean? Like about just people, you know, assholes that I've known my whole life growing up around or whatever, and how they're fucking everything up for the rest of us and whatnot. Like, it all comes from like a personal perspective, and it's usually either based in pain or, you know, rage or both. So there's a lot of that in there.
I mean, I feel like for me, most the one of the hardest things that I'm kind of going through right now is how much of your pain do you talk about on stage without it becoming the self-loathing, self-pity kind of a thing. I think that's the part that I'm kind of struggling with. I was telling this story about me being like, I don't know, 13 years old or something, and about my dad. I was doing a play. I was doing a play in my school in Pakistan, and my dad came to pick me up. We were supposed to go to my uncle's wedding, and I was supposed to be ready, and my dad didn't want to come and watch my play. And I, as I was rushing out of the room, I dropped my lipstick that my mom had sent me because my mom was in America at the time because two of my brothers have polio, and she was here getting them treated. And, you know, so I live with my dad. And long story short, I said to my dad, I'm like, Dad, I got to run back. I got to grab my lipstick. It fell and Mom sent it to me. It means a lot to me. And apparently I was in there for like more than the time that he was waiting for me a while, for 10, 15 minutes. And he basically came barging in and like grabbed me by my hair and started like beating the pulp out of me right in front of everyone and like dragged me by my hair and just like dragged me out of school, right? That leaves just a tad bit of traumas when that happens.
Yeah.
Just a tad bit. And I think. Yeah. And I think.
And you've been trying to tell that story on stage is what you're saying.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Like people, because I don't want people to pity me. Like I don't want your
too
fucking
much.
Pity.
Right. Well, I have a bit like that right now also, except it's nowhere near as traumatizing as yours is. So that would be even more difficult to do than what I'm about to tell you.
Yeah.
I've been finding certain crowds are just would prefer that I didn't bring this up, I think. But to me, it's like hilarious. Like, yes, it's fucked up. And yes, it would, you know, mess a kid up, which it did. Yeah. But I also think it's hilarious. And it's this true story of the time. My mom once picked me up from kindergarten in blackface, right? She was like,
what the? What was going through her head?
This is true. She wasn't, it wasn't like vaudeville style, like that classic blackface get up. She was in costume. She was dressed up in costume as Aunt Jemima, the syrup lady. Because, you see, Mona, it was pancake day at the diner she worked at.
Got it.
And so she thought she was just really going to, you know,
get
spice
into character.
Things up for the client to get into character. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then she got off her shift. It was time for school to get out. So she came and picked me up without going home to change. So she shows up as Aunt Jemima, including, you know, the makeup, all of her exposed skin was covered in brown makeup or whatever, because that was.
Did she look like me? Know. Did she have my kind of coloring, or what did she look like?
It was darker than your skin for sure, but still not like, not that like literal black face. So, like I said, like vaudeville style. But like, anyway,
I do like this joke because it's happening on MLK Day, and just kind of.
You're so right. That's true. I didn't even. I've been telling this on stage for the past like, you know, week or so already.
Yeah.
But you're right. There's a special kind of irony in this joke coming up today of all days. But I've been trying to do this lately, and it's like I did a show of Jeff Ross's out here, right? So Jeff Ross, Roastmaster, right? Most of the people presumably are Jeff Ross fans. So they're like, you know, they're pretty hardcore. Like you probably can't say very much that's going to offend the Jeff Ross audience.
Yeah.
And so at that show, it did great.
Yeah.
Like it went over fantastically. But at other more typical like LA shows, people very much tense up. And I think it's just like, they're like, God, we'd really rather not talk about this right now if you don't mind. Yeah, blackface in any context, really.
Sure.
But the context I tell it in is talking about how, you know, like my mom fucked me up as a kid.
Sure.
It's like, you know, here's a good example.
Yeah.
And I tell that story. I'm trying to navigate. It's hard to do that. You know, Drew, I don't want to tell stories out of school, but Drew, who you mentioned earlier, who I tour with, his brother is in prison long term, and I don't want to get into the details, but Drew has tried to turn that whole story into a stand-up bit off and on for years,
right.
And so far he's mostly found that it's just too much for people, you know, it's like way darker or way more fucked up or whatever than it is funny to most people.
I mean, when I talk about it, I mean, I see people getting like really tense, people getting really scared. I mean, you know, I mean, for me, like I try to diffuse the situation by saying like, do you know how hard like, you know, choking or any of that is for me in the bedroom now, because my dad fucked that up for me in the foreplay.
Yeah.
Like that foreplay is gone. Like I can't have that.
I bet.
because it's just like, I'm just like, daddy, like any kind of pulling of hair, I'm just like, it's over. I just, you know, that foreplay is out of the question for me. People are like, you know, I'm just like, it didn't fucking happen to you. It happened to me. Relax. Like, relax. It's fine.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know what you mean. Again, that particular example is, yeah, even more hardcore than anything I've ever attempted. But I do know what you mean, because I've had multiple run-ins with that myself. Got trying to mine comedy from the darkness. I did have a bit that worked really well that I did for a long time that was entirely about my mom being a drug addict, though, which I was always kind of proud of.
And how would that go down?
It's been a long time since I've done it, but it was basically, it just focused on like how ridiculous she really honestly thought that I didn't know what was going on, you know, and how now I'm just insulted by that looking back on it, because like her and all her clientele, you know, they were pillbillies, like not the most suave operatives, you know what I mean, when it comes to keeping secrets and stuff. And they would talk in code, they'd have secret code words, but they didn't make any sense. Like they'd come over and ask my mom if she had any vegetables, you know, and I would just be like, you know, I live with her, right? I ain't had a vegetable in 6 goddamn months. It's like, she sleeps till noon. She's not a farmer.
Right.
You know, like shit like that. Right. And it just went on in that same vein. But yeah, and it was always, again, structured in a way that it was more funny than fucked up to your average
right.
person.
Yeah.
And that's the balance you have to find, because if you tip too much on the side of fucked up,
yeah,
then it's going to be hard to get most crowds
honestly,
to come with you.
For me, it's like one of the things that I've noticed, you know, when I go and do like the regular LA audience or, you know, wherever, New York, more of the mainstream audience, they're just like, oh my God, yeah, they want to be like a little bit more, I guess, compassionate and want to hear your story. But it's interesting when I do it for the Muslim crowd or for like the South Asian or the Middle Eastern crowd, they always have like this weird awkwardness where they're just like, oh, that happened to you, but did that really happen to you? Because they also always kind of have this sense as if I'm making this stuff up or somehow
yeah.
that it's reflecting poorly on them or the culture because of
right.
all the stories and perhaps the stereotypes. So they feel like, oh my God, you're like playing into the stereotypes. And I'm just like, I'm not playing into the stereotypes. I'm just telling you my truth and what I've experienced, right? And people just try
yep.
to make it more personal about them. And it's like, bitch, it's not about you. It's like, it's not about
oh.
you. I'm talking to you about my life, you know?
That particular dynamic you just described is something that I very much relate to, telling stories or, you know, stories, sometimes stand up, sometimes not even stand up in interviews or whatever. And they're all true. They're completely true.
Right.
About like my hometown or my childhood or whatever. And people will get mad at me for the exact same reasons you said. It's like, you know, you make us look bad with that, or you make Salina look bad, or you make your family look bad, or you make just Southerners look bad. You're playing
yeah.
in the stereotypes, like you said, you know, like you were just saying.
Yep.
And it has always pissed me off too, because I'm like, look, I'm telling that story because that happened. You
That's
know what
correct.
I mean? Like, I can't help the fact that it happened. And also, like, I've always gone out of my way to try to do the opposite, meaning, like, if there's some stereotypical shit that has happened to me or is true, then I'll acknowledge that, but also go out of my way to point out how ridiculous it is to think that every single person, either of a certain race or from a certain place or of a certain religion or whatever,
yeah.
that they're all the same in any way. Like,
that's right.
And that applies to fucking, you know, poor white people from the South just
that's
as
right.
much as it does to Muslims or whoever.
That's right.
Of course, that's ridiculous. And
yep.
so I always go out of my way to try to talk about that also. But if yep. I had some redneck shit happen to me and I want to talk about it, I'm going to talk about it.
That's
you
right.
Know?
That's right. And you know, it just it perfectly kind of brings me to the point about why did I have a straight white guy a comedian as my guest? It's because you are the liberal redneck. And for me, on Minority Reports, it's not just about being minorities by ethnicity,
right.
but it's also a minority point of view, which I really feel that
yeah.
you have.
Yeah, yeah, there ain't, yeah. I'm not a unicorn, but there's like, I'm part of a pack of unicorns, I think. There's like, you know,
yeah.
I don't know. There's not that many of us out there, but we do exist. But yeah, it's funny, very briefly, I don't know if you are aware, if you do, in like the writing world out here, like not stand up writing, like you know, narrative writing, TV writing or whatever, every one of the studios and networks and stuff, all of them, they have these diversity programs,
right? They do.
Where they like give out, and I actually have done one of those.
That's awesome.
NBC. I thought that when you said that earlier about a straight white guy on Minority Reports, NBC has a diversity program for late night comedy writing specifically.
Yeah.
And I did it in 2015. And it was funny because my pitch to them was a version of what you said about me. You know, I was like, look, yeah, I know I'm a straight white dude, but you can't tell me that within like late night writers' rooms in New York and LA or whatever, that my perspective is not an extreme minority. You know what I mean? Like that is ever, you know, represented in any way. And I think that should, you know, count a little bit.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess they bought it, but it is, it's funny to tell people that I was in one of those diversity programs. I'm going to tell them that I was on Minority Report.
You
too.
Should. I also want to know, did you have some like pissed off, like minority people there in the group who were looking at you? They're like, what's this white guy doing here?
No. Maybe, I don't know. They certainly didn't. We ended up by the end of our thing, we were all, you know, we're all friends, and we're getting along great. When I first walked in, they very, you know, definitely may have thought that. But when the NBC people sort of went around the table and like introduced everybody, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
They said a version of what we both just said a minute ago about me, I think, to kind of diffuse that. They didn't come out and say, you might be wondering why this straight white dude is in here. They didn't say that.
That'd be too much on the nose.
Like, the thing about Trey is he whatever, and they like, and they said something like, you know, and here in our program, it's about not just diversity of, you know, race or ethnicity or whatever, but also diversity of experience, you know, or something like that. So they kind of like, I think, tried to get out in front of it or something with me. but no, it ended up going fine.
See, that makes me really happy because NBC came and validated my point, which is you have a minority point of view, and here you are on Minority Reports. I'm very happy that you came on. I was looking at some of your IMDb credits here, and you guys have an untitled well-read project. Can you talk a little bit about that, or is that the...
Well, it yeah, yes and no. We've had,
as much as you want to, there's no pressure or whatever.
Well, like, it's also just that, like, it's been a few different things, and it's currently in the middle of changing again. Do you know what I mean?
Because
that's how that goes with pilots and stuff. It bounces around. And, I mean, I've got the well-read group thing with Corey and Drew. I've also had my own, like, singular pilot that I've been trying, that I've went through, like, four iterations of right now or something.
Yeah.
It's, you know, turns out really, really hard to get a TV show made all the way and onto the air, but I'm still, you know, trying very much. And I've got a couple of those going, but they're all, I used to talk more about them in detail, like early on, but then as they kept like not happening at one place and going to another place and then changing completely, you know what I mean? I kind of just stopped getting into details until we get to a more like concrete
no,
stage
that's smart.
Where it's like, until something is actually airing. But I am actively working on it. Yeah. And we have me and Corey and Drew are in the middle of doing some sketch comedy for Comedy Central's digital platform.
Awesome.
We've put three out already and we're shooting more right now, and they'll be coming out soon.
Have they aired yet or no?
There's three of them out on Comedy Central's Comedy Central's YouTube channel and their website and all of their different digital platforms. And if you just look for Well Read, or if you Google my name or whatever, then they should come up.
Oh,
but
awesome.
There's three out so far, but we're making more right now. So
I'd love to totally check it out. What else? What else you got going on? You got some other?
We're breaking from touring right now, just taking a little bit of time off. But I mean, we'll be going back out starting in March of this year, and then from then on, over the course of the rest of 2020, we'll be out and about all around the country. So again, if you Google me or go to our website, which is Well Read, that's R-E-D, wellreadcomedy.com, see all that information for all that stuff. And like you mentioned earlier, the Well-Read podcast is an ongoing thing too. Every week, every Wednesday, we drop a new episode.
That's awesome.
So if you listen to this and didn't know who I was and you are at all into, like, you know, a person with my accent saying the things that I say, if you listen to our podcast, you get that times three, because Tori and Drew are like me in a lot of ways.
That's right. They're it's a fantastic podcast. I absolutely love your podcast. Do you want to do some of your social media plug before we wrap up?
Yeah, it's all just my name, T-R-A-E Crowder, Trey Crowder, like on pretty much all of them. So if you just like I said, Google it and whatever, you'll find any of them that way.
I love it. Well, Trey, this was really a lot of fun. Did you have fun?
I had a great time. I always have a great time when I talk to you, Mona.
Feeling is mutual, my friend. Feeling is mutual. Thank you so much for joining us, Trey Crowder. Thank you so much for joining us.
Bye.
Bye.
Do I need to...
I'm going to end you.
Should I get off here?